It's hard to ignore the greater attention being given to happiness by politicians, perhaps craving an escape from being judged by the unhelpful growth figures and the dismal science of economics. The notion of gross national happiness was once confined to Bhutan, a remote country unlikely to trouble the international prosperity statistics. But what sounded like an improbable notion is now pursued quite seriously. The EU runs its own happiness barometer, measuring well-being across the member states, and David Cameron recently launched a happiness index. So what was thought of by some detractors to be the nutty innovation of young think tankers is attracting proper attention after all. Gus O'Donnell is the former head of the civil service. He served under leaders from John Major to David Cameron, and he's now heading a commission on well-being for the Legatum Institute. Joining us too is Juliette Michelson from the New Economics Foundation and the economist Paul Ormerod. Now, Gus, why has happiness come up the political agenda now, particularly now, so long after other measures like GDP have been used for time immemorial? And what's the importance of it?
Well, I think, going back to your earlier discussion, we'd like our policies to have happy endings, please. We'd like people to be better off, and we'd like to understand what it is about making them better off. There has been a tradition in economics way back to actually try and think about how you decide whether one country is richer than another or whether one policy is better than another. And it's very early on, we decided that just using income measures wasn't enough. So we looked at social development indicators and all the rest of it. The UN did this back in the 50s. Ian Little and Jim Merlies developed some very fancy ways of doing this called social cost benefit analysis, project appraisal, that could be applied to each individual project to work out whether this actually made a difference to people's well-being,
if
you like.
But you must admit, in all those years that you spent in government, and I was covering politics for at least some of them, these were not things that were put before the public mind. No. Governments, whether they were Labour, Conservative, whatever they were, seemed sort of quite happy with the rough-and-ready measures. They were happy to be judged on employment, on inflation, on GDP. This does feel quite new to put it front of house, as Mr. Cameron has done.
Yes, because you're basically trying to say, what is the overall measure? And unfortunately, a lot of times people have said the overall measure is GDP. You know, that's the income of the whole economy.
Gross domestic product.
Gross domestic product. And the problem with that is it takes no account of actually who gets that. So no account of the distribution of that income. And also, GDP is an incredibly flawed measure. I mean, there's not an economist who would stand up and say, actually, this makes sense. It leaves out leisure, lots of things that are really bad. You know, you can have an earthquake, it would increase your GDP. Why? Because the rebuilding will count and the destruction doesn't count at all. So it's basically quite nutty. We've known that, but it's rough and ready. And the interesting question for us is we've always wanted to get at proper measures of well-being. And the problem has been, how do we do it? And I can go back to what Edward Skidelsky is saying there, is to get to the fundamental part of it. He said that issue about pain. How do we know whether there's
measuring
something
pain?
How do you measure pain? So how can you measure this? Well, actually, I think anyone listening will know they can tell the difference between being pricked by a needle and being run over by a truck. So as an individual, we can tell the difference between intense pain and a minor pain.
Are we so clear, though, about well-being in any way that we could report it enough to build policy?
Yes, I think we are, because we can also say there are times when we've been very sad and times when we've been very happy and times when we've felt that our life is very fulfilled and times when it's not. The issue really, and the person that really got to this, the kind of hero of this debate, is Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize winner, in his Collective Choice and Social Theory. You can measure those individual things in a cardinal way, so we can add them up. The real difficulty for us is, can you make comparisons between individuals, what we call interpersonal comparability? That's the hard thing. We've never completely cracked it, but we are now starting to find ways. Some of the neuroscience might get us into that territory.
I should say that anyone wants to hear a bit more from Amartya Sen, we'll be having him on the programme this week on Thursday. Now, Paul Ormerod, what is wrong, as an economist, what is wrong with the idea of optimising well-being, as Gus has suggested? It sounds like a rather positive thing that the dismal science of economics might deliver.
Well, of course, it's Gus is perfectly right. There's much more to life than simply income and work. And gradually, over the time, people take more, spend more time at leisure rather than take a pay increase. You might have more holidays. People spend longer in education.
You're talking in the right week for that.
There's all sorts of things. There's all sorts of things which motivate people. It's when we actually look at the happiness data. Now, Gus says there are problems measuring gross domestic product. It's meant to measure output in a market economy. Gross domestic product, the statistics were first put together in the 1930s, when that was the serious problem. We had a catastrophic recession in the early 30s, far bigger than the one we've just experienced. And so the pressing policy problem was to measure output, to tell the politicians. So people are now measuring happiness. But when we look at what's happened to measurements of happiness over time, it doesn't seem to have any correlation with things which you think would make people happy.
Like what?
So, for example, whether it's in Britain or America, if you look 30 or 40 years, happiness has been flat, measured happiness, but, say, public expenditure has increased, or gender equality has gone up, or in America, racial inequality has fallen. So things which you think would make people happier, would make, in some ways, for people to feel better, doesn't seem to correlate in any way with what happens to happiness over time. In fact, nothing seems to alter it. It stays more or less the same, whatever happens.
Stubbing your middle. Girls, I'm going to come back to you on that, but I'd just like to bring in Juliet here. Is there really an economics of happiness, or is it always about the downgrading of something else, whether it's growth or the free market, or some other agenda that isn't really just about happiness?
No, I think happiness and well-being have a really central role to play in policy, in macroeconomic policy and public policy more generally. We heard Gus talk a little bit about the kind of history of the economic discipline. I mean, really, economists back in the 19th century were discussing this question, can we compare between people? And they decided there was no robust way of measuring. So they invented a concept of utility and decided that basically they would just look at the way people spent their money and that would be a good enough stand-in. But what's really happened in the last 30 years is that there has been the growth of a really now considerable literature. I wouldn't quite put it in the terms that Richard Layard said as a new science. It's really quite an established literature now. And contrary to what Paul just said, actually we know a lot about all the different factors that are associated with the way that people respond to these measures in terms of assessing their lives overall. So we know, for example, that there is a measurable relationship with income. If you're on a really low income, you're likely to say that you're not very satisfied with your life overall. The interesting thing about that is that if you're on a very high income, that doesn't necessarily mean that your assessment of your life is going to be that much better with someone on a sort of an okay salary. But there is all sorts of relationships that the data has picked up with employment status, with relationships, with housing conditions, with even things like air pollution. So we actually know a lot, and this is important evidence.
Is that fair, Paul, that you were actually just screening out a lot of things that you do know? Because
I was just saying that there are some obvious things which you think would make people happy, which just don't seem to be related to it.
So now, we know what makes them unhappy.
No, what Juliet's saying, I mean, if you take people in very poor countries, then of course, if people get very, very big transitions, then that does make them happy. I'm talking about the happiness data as it actually exists in developed countries like Britain and America. And there's data going back now over 40 years in America, and essentially the series is flat. It shows no trend. There are little bubbles up and down from year to year, but nothing happens. Nothing seems to make in aggregate. Now, there are some things like, as Juliet says, like relationships seem to be a very important way of making people happy. Now, we might think, what should policy mean? I mean, I suppose a rather cynical way of looking at it is that GDP or output was measured, and no sooner had it been measured than politicians wanted to try and control it. And as we can see from the financial crisis, they've not been terribly successful at that. And it will be an irresistible urge in politicians to try to control this measure in some way.
So once you measure it, someone wants to control it.
Absolutely. As soon as you measure anything, they'll say yes, and it's up 0.1% this month, and therefore vote for me.
Lord O'Donnell, who spent so long in government, is that a fair charge? That once you come up with it, in a way, happiness is elusive because it simply shifts then because people want to control its definition and what it is.
Well, I think you're right about the importance of measurement. But if you treasure something, you should measure it, would be my philosophy of this. So if we think that, you know, what is the goal of society? And I think we do understand there are some things which really do make an enormous amount of difference to people's lives. The ONS happiness data told us some really interesting things about work and employment. You know, there are a lot of people out there who would like to work longer hours than they can at the minute, who are part-time employed but would like the opportunity to work more. They're one of the unhappiest groups. If you look at things like what are the sources of real problems, mental illness, you know, people, that's massively important. So if you're just looking at the, and I can understand this case about getting rid of the bad side, right? I was thinking of, you know, Richard wrote the book on happiness. I could write the book called Not Bad. You know, let's get rid of the bad stuff. And I could even write the review, because the reviewer would say, this book's not bad, but it's not that good either. But
it's very noble of you to review your own book before you've written it. Well, that's a first, even on Night Waves. But I did want to bring up the idea that this reporting happiness or measuring it, Paul used or indicated the word flawed earlier on, that it just might be more difficult than we think it is. And if you look at the Eurobarometer on it, it does just track the economy pretty much. It crashes down as soon as the economy gets into serious trouble, and it gets worse when the Eurozone sort of begins to have serious trouble. So doesn't it show that what people want is their governments to develop, to deliver prosperity and stability, and they'll look after happiness themselves?
I think it's certainly the case that prosperity and stability can help, although, as Paul pointed out, prosperity of itself doesn't have that simpler relationship. Certainly for poor countries and for poor individuals, who even within rich countries, increases in income do tend to be associated with increases in happiness. But once you get above a certain point, I think everyone knows this, you know, it comes down to things like relative income. So, you know, if your neighbour, if you get a new car, you feel really happy. If your neighbour gets a slightly bigger car, then, you know, you're not so sure that you're as happy as you were with that. And I think that's one of the things where there is an element here. It gets you into some quite philosophical territory of, should we be thinking within our education system about what is it that really delivers long-term happiness, well-being, a flourishing society? And what are the things that we should, as a society, want people to want?
Should you want people to want things, or is that sort of paternalism run a bit wild?
Well, I think that these measures actually really, in some ways, a very democratic way of thinking about outcomes, because they ask people to judge for themselves all the different aspects that in their lives and come up with an overall judgment about how they feel that's turned out. And so in some ways you're removing the expert voice. You're not saying, you know, we think it's these five things which are important. You're actually handing that over to people themselves in your measurement. There is this fear about paternalism, and I think this suggestion that about gaming of measures. We know these sort of examples around kind of A&E department waiting times, where stories of ambulances circling hospital car parks so that the clock didn't start. I don't think that's a serious concern in this case, because how could you, as a government, really game these wellbeing measures? As long as we trust in the neutrality of the people of our Office of National Statistics who are producing them, then any policy that's going to enhance them is really got to be a good thing.
But Paul, I mean, is that, leaving aside whether you can game things and to what extent, is this at all desirable anyway? Or is it actually directly not desirable?
Well, indeed. I mean, the question's been raising of people, Gus and Juliet, saying we want people to be happy. In a sense, it's a small step to say we know how to make people happy. I think on this count, the most sympathetic person in the whole of English literature is Comrade O'Brien, the inner party member whose task in 1984 is to make Winston Smith happy. And he finally does. So it doesn't seem to be a good case for advocate for happiness policy, that particular example. But I think there's a wider problem here, which I think is a problem in society much more general than this. That when we're talking about measure and what the drivers are, in a sense, we're handing control of democratic political decisions to experts with clipboards. So in some way, if you're a politician and you're not somehow familiar with the latest regression analysis that Juliet and her team have carried out, your participation, even as an elected politician, is somehow invalidated, where it should be the politicians, good politicians, have always taken account of a wide range of measures, and realise that people simply aren't just interested in income, and they try to get re-elected on a very wide platform.
You seem to be suggesting a rather dark side to this, that it could lead you into what, though? I mean, people tend to talk about clipboards meaning something they don't like.
Why would it be so bad? There is a book by an ex-president of Harvard on the happiness literature in which he actually states people are surprisingly ignorant of what makes them happy. So there is this very paternalistic, interfering tendency which people with the best intentions in the happiness movement are perhaps not fully aware of the potential implications.
Gus, what makes you think you can tell people how to be happy?
Well, there's an interesting paradox in the paternalism issue in that I am quite for a bit of liberal paternalism. I mean, that's actually the thesis behind the nudge philosophy and a lot of the behavioural science work that's going on at the moment. I think the idea that people are fully rational, perfectly informed, always make the right decisions, never make mistakes, which is the basis of certain sorts of neoclassical theories, I think is complete rubbish. I think if you start to say in a world, actually, there are lots of people out there who really do want to do certain things. For example, they really do want to donate their organs, but they just haven't got round to it. Should we be helping, nudging them to do that?
Assuming, of course, that you, the nudger, always get it right. You assumed that the neoclassical theory didn't get it right. What makes you think that the enlightened nudger always gets it right?
Well, and that's the debate we need to have, and that's where I strongly agree with Paul. That's what politics is really all about, and it's really important to get individuals' perceptions at the heart of this. I think one of the issues that Edward Skidelsky has about the measurement is he doesn't think individuals are the best measure of their own happiness. And that, of course, does create for him a real problem about using the happiness measures.
But broadly speaking, you do.
Broadly speaking, I think people are good at that a lot of the time, but not all of the time. So I'm broadly with the individuals, but I think there are times when people do tend... They tend to be quite short-sighted, and there are certain things they tend to get wrong.
Juliet, I wondered if you saw any danger here that this becomes so nebulous that governments don't get measured on other things like reducing poverty or decreasing inequalities. They can simply start a discussion about happiness. My impression is that Downing Street is quite keen to discuss happiness at the moment. We end up with a lot of talk about what it is, and then they're not measured on things that are perhaps a little bit more unwelcome to them.
Yes, I mean, if it's just political window dressing, then of course it's not a force for positive change in our society. And I think one of the ways that we can avoid that is for people across the board, opposition political parties, those involved in analysing social policies in different fields, in health, education, to really grab hold of this now very considerable data resource we've got. The ONS in July published its survey
of
200,000 people across the country, meaning that we can now look at people's reported well-being in a really fine-grained way, in a way that we've not been able to before. And that's really a new source of evidence to hold politicians to account for their actions.
Paul?
Well, I think in general, in the social sciences, there aren't many meaningful relationships out there to be discovered. And the mere fact that we can suddenly have a database of 200,000, or even through big data and the internet and social media, databases of millions or tens of millions, or even thousands of millions of mobile phone calls, doesn't mean there'll be any meaningful relations there. And in fact, it increases very considerably the risk that we will find false positive correlations. If there are so many data points, we're bound to find some that appear to be causal and correlated, whereas in fact they are not at all. So I think there are very serious risks of using big data, particularly given the state of scientific techniques we have for analysing
it. I think the counter to that is, as Paul rightly said, in the 30s, the economists starting to measure GDP, and just to be clear, a lot of GDP is still measured by survey measures, which is the thing that Skidelsky's worried about for happiness. So surveys are basically there all the time. The issue really is, given that we devote vast proportion of our resources to measuring things like GDP, should we devote a small proportion to measuring things like happiness and well-being? In the past, we've done nothing on this. We've got no back data that's actually as useful as we would really like to be able to analyse the kinds of issues that Paul was raising, to come up with falsifiable hypotheses. You know, we want proper theories that give us something we can test, that that say that that will allow us to sort out these debates.
There was
at
a
the
small
moment,
howl
we just
of
haven't
pain
got the data.
From Paul along the way, well, so just, I felt I should let him
GDP data has been around now for at least 70 years. And it's not, economists haven't succeeded in using it to falsify or establish hypotheses. There are still very strong disagreements amongst economists as to what caused it, like the current argument about, should be more public spending to get us out of a recession. Some economists say yes and others say no. So I think I admire your optimism, Gus. You know, I admire the fact that you're seeking scientific truth and trying to move the world forward. But I think the experience of GDP suggests you'll be a disappointed man.
Well, there we must leave it, happily disagreeing. My thanks to Paul Ormerod, to Gus O'Donnell and to Juliet Michelson.